You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, May 23rd, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mark Ames, journalist at Pando Daily. We're talking about the Donald Trump of the 19th century and the danger of a xenophobic plutocrat exploiting racial fear and trumped up terrorism charges to forward his own career. We're also going to talk about Gary Johnson, the Gary Johnson scam, as the former New Mexico governor who people think is cool because he likes pot, gears up for another presidential run. Mark Ames is going to remind everybody of his actual record and the hustle behind his campaign. Also, President Obama in Hanoi in Vietnam lifting an arms embargo on that country dating back decades. Human rights activists are concerned. The Chinese pretend they're not concerned, but they might very well be concerned. We'll get into what that's all about. Drone strike takes out the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. That organization is scrambling to regroup and find a new leader. Also, a Blue Lives Matter law is about to get signed into law in Louisiana. What is that about? At the same time as another officer is acquitted in the killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. This election is still dragging on. Democratic primary. We've got some sound from Bernie and Hillary. We have some insight from Noam Chomsky. He's a real establishment accommodationist, apparently. And Glenn Beck and Alex Jones. The feud between two incredibly unhealthy looking conspiracy theorists continues. They have thoughts.
Dreams do come true for me.
Nightmares. Nightmares or dreams. I guess dreams from a YouTube's numbers perspective.
Okay, no. Just a life perspective, this is my dream. That they're feuding. I'm so happy.
They really hate each other.
Oh, that's so great.
Because Alex Jones.
Thank you.
Glenn Beck bit Alex Jones' style.
Oh, for a second, I thought you were going to say actually bit him. Which would be, I mean, it's not out of...
Who would be more likely to bite who?
Alex Jones is rabid.
Alex, he does actually literally
It's like
look
foams
rabid.
At the mouth, literally.
So last week, I spent a bit more time listening to both of these bozos.
Yes.
And they play each other's clips and make fun of it, kind of like we make fun of their clips.
Right.
It's very bizarre, dynamic.
I feel like Glenn Beck is a better broadcaster, but Alex Jones is definitely the originator.
Yeah, they're both pros.
They're both pros. They are pros. We're running behind, so let me do just brief housekeeping. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys on iTunes. We're at about 110 iTunes reviews, so thank you so much for making that happen. We have a brand new episode dropping tomorrow. Last week, we talked with Grant McCracken about the dark value economy. He's an anthropologist. And we also talked about the Facebook algorithm and what defines middle class. So the show is growing Really excited about it. And now it's on Stitcher, Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. There's new news for our members. So I'm going to throw it to Kelly. She's going to explain it to you. And don't you wish that this was relevant for you, non-members? But it's not until you join.
We are launching a new system to distribute the podcast today. It's going to be an improvement, and we're going to be able to improve.
Significant.
We're going to be able to improve our website, and we're also going to be able to improve the way that the show is able to be purchased, etc. Members might experience double links is the problem we expect in their feed. So if you could just be patient while we sort that out, hopefully that's will be the only problem, because that's not too bad a problem.
Yeah, basically, if there's
just
something,
bear with us.
If there's something buggy with your feed in the next few days, we'll just send us a note, but we're probably on it.
Yeah, we're expecting a few hiccups, but overall, I wish we were playing the Beatles song. Things are getting better all the time.
Yeah, it'll be really. Yeah, it's a really cool thing.
It's going to be a very significant improvement. And another great incentive is if you already don't have enough to become a member, if you're not yet, go to majority.fm/become a member. And speaking of making things better and better all the time, ZipRecruiter is today's sponsor. And as a consigliere to a small business owner and someone who is really around a lot of small businesses, that's another part of Two Dope Boys, actually, is kind of chronicling how you actually grow something on any scale. You know that hiring people, the best people, is essential. And if you are hiring, you need to post the job to find in places where you can find the best candidate. And posting a job in one place is just simply not enough to find quality candidates. If you want the perfect hire, you need to post the job in all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all in a single click. Find a candidate in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And as Bill Clinton would always say, you got to say it three times. Three reasons. Three things. He actually did say that. It's a speech method that I learned from Bill Clinton. You got to make 3 points. So one more time, try it for free today. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. We're going to add a link to the majority.fm blog, and this is an indispensable tool for your business of any size. We will be right back with Mark Ames on the Majority Report.
Can't kill me again if you never kill me or break. Yes, I. And we say, Jah over evil, life over death. Demon can't kill me again. We say, good over evil, life over death. Satan can't kill me. Here comes the hot staper. Fire burning hotter than paper. That song you written proper than later. Protected from the crown of my head, straight down to the very soul of the crepe, yeah. Me have a chat for them, them send gunshot poison to your accident. Long time them a try like half my oxygen, but you're in control, can't take me soul. Jah over evil, life over death. Demon can't kill me again. Me say, life over death, demon can't kill me, Them put poison in a liquor, try curse me. A good thing, me no drink, me no thirsty. From the day my mother birthed me, still I see I perch me, nobody can hurt me. Them disguise Jezebel in a the biggest way. Send her come to give me the biggest A. Can it left her in dismay? A long time, them a try up until this day. Me say,
life of a death. Satan can't kill me again. Me say, life of a death. Me say, them can't kill me, can't kill me again. Can't kill me again. If they never kill me, I'm ready, ready. Alright, them did want mummy fi a bat me, bet me dead. But unfortunately them never know said I want me set the trend. If he come step on snake and fartile.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mark Ames. He's a journalist and co-host at the War Nerd at War Nerd Radio. Is that correct, Mark?
Radio War Nerd, yeah, it's a subscriber podcast.
Subscriber podcast, which is great, and I've listened to it. I've followed the work of War Nerd and your work for a long time. Also, a friend of mine, Mark. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's always good to be talking with you. I want to kind of step back a little bit and look at some of the sort of hidden darkness of this election cycle. Because, you know, I think it's sort of upfront for everybody. We know that on one hand, we have this kind of buffoonish sort of like clown proto-fascist who will be the Republican nominee. And I'm going to want your thoughts on him later. We obviously
talking about Hillary, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about Hillary. Well, I don't know if she's okay. She's not as clowny, though. She's not that entertaining.
No,
yeah.
I'm the clown here, so yeah.
Wait, who's... Well, we'll come up for a good descriptor for Hillary. So we got Hillary, and I guess the fact that that joke even works tells you everything you need to know about Hillary. And then, you know, and then we've got Bernie, but frankly, I mean, I love the guy, but I think if we're being real, it's a wrap. But we got to get to... A person that we're going to hear a lot about over the next couple of months. And we're going to hear about him in two different ways. We're going to hear from some people who, you know, mystifyingly, even though they're on the left and they feel so important about voting third party, that instead of voting for Jill Stein, for whatever reason, they're going to be drawn to him because of some fantasy they've told themselves about his policy on drones and his policy on weed. And then there's going to be another contingent of people, of very, very sleazy and disingenuous people who have built their careers on race baiting, on garbage economics, and on everything else that Donald Trump is running on just better than they ever did. And they're going to say, you know what? He's not a real conservative. So I'm going to support a guy named Gary Johnson. And that's where you come in, because you are a Gary Johnson scholar. He's the former governor of New Mexico. Yeah. He's going to run as a Libertarian candidate. Who is this guy and where is he coming from?
So Gary Johnson, yeah, he sort of came out of nowhere in New Mexico politics. And I think it was 1994 in the election in 1994 for governor. And he wound up winning because the Democrats, the Democrats usually have kind of owned that state. And it is, I believe it's the poorest state or has the highest rate of poverty in the country, particularly because of a large Native American population as well, pretty devastated Native American populations. So he wound up squeezing through, not with a majority vote, either the first or second term, but because the liberals, the Democrats were split when one of the candidates ran against. And there were, you know, it's like a lot of states, it's got some rough and sleazy politics going on. And so there were questions even then about, you know, who might have helped engineer the split on the Democrat-liberal side. In any event, that allowed Gary Johnson to to become governor. Nobody really knew, or I'll put it this way, nobody remembers how he governed from 94 through, I want to say it was 94 through 2002, I believe. What they remember him is this incarnation of him, the second incarnation, starting around the 2000s after he left New Mexico. He sort of became a Cato Institute regular and then eventually became the Libertarian Party candidate in 2012 for president. They knew him as the real left, the real liberal, the libertarian who's really for legalizing weed, unlike, you know, unlike the other guys, the leftists. I mean, the liberals are fake. The Democrats are fake. The Republicans, there's no difference between them. Gary Johnson is the real liberty. He really cares about civil liberties. He's really an anti-interventionist. He's really for, you know, same-sex marriage and all these myths
right.
that grew up around him, which, you know, the extremely well-funded Koch network can PR these things because ever since they really set up the libertarian movement in the 70s, the idea has been to basically to bring in the far right ideas through liberal left, you know, fake liberal left kind of feints to the
right,
left.
Right. And that's why this story matters so much. It's not just the story of a kind of like overhyped former mediocre governor. We'll get into it. But literally, like, this is the vehicle through which this same process that you say, and I want you to get to in a second, going back to the 70s, that there has been an attempt to make libertarianism anything other than just sort of this feudalism built on a kind of bizarre metaphysics and bad novels by Ayn Rand into something that's trendy, into something that's humane. One funny kind of addendum to this, and then I want to, you know, work it backwards to the 70s. We used to have a guy that called the show all the time, and his name was Jim from PA, and he would breathe really heavily. And he would call in and he would say, like, are you ready to admit that you support war crimes because you voted for Obama? I'm voting for Gary Johnson because he opposes the drones. Now, it just so happened that literally an interview came out, I think it was in Reason, where Gary Johnson actually straight up said, like, nah, I wouldn't really change much of the drone program as sort of, you know, Obama's done it. If I was president. And what was kind of striking was, frankly, like, first of all, I mean, if we're going to have a drone program like we have, which I have innate questions and problems with, I would much prefer Barack Obama overseeing it than Gary Johnson. And it was just amazing that it was like this whole thing that this guy literally called up a dozen times accusing, you know, us of being like handmaidens of war crimes. And his savior candidate said straight up, yeah, I'm not going to do any different.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same thing with Ron Paul and then Rand Paul to a certain degree. But yeah, Gary Johnson has come out. He's against closing Guantanamo. I mean, Obama at least tried. Whether you believe he put in enough effort or not is another question.
Sure.
But he tried and he did come out against it. He's Gary Johnson's against closing Guantanamo. He was for military intervention in Uganda when we first started flitting around in there.
Oh, was it because of the Kony video? Was he like high and he watched the Kony video and he's like, we gotta go, man.
It was about potential oil there.
Right,
it was really what it was about.
Right.
He's come out in very strong statements that he is for using the U.S. military to protect Israel, if its interests are in danger.
Right.
That Israel's interests are America's. Like, I don't see where this guy is some huge difference. Ron Paul, you know, you talk about war crimes. I used to hear this argument from a lot of Ron Paul apologists on the left and flax, basically. And they either intentionally lied to themselves, or they definitely lied to the rest of us. You go back and look at the record, Ron Paul voted for the original AUMF, the authorization use of military force. That is the first one, the initial one, has been the legal basis, which has, you know, been challenged, but has been... It has been the legal basis used for everything, including all the drone assassinations going back to 2002. For the warrantless, it was the original justification for warrantless surveillance.
Right.
It's the justification for basically every war except for Iraq, which had a separate AUMF bill.
And there was
it.
Only one, so, as you know, there was only yes, one person yes. that voted against it, and that was Barbara Lee.
So why are these people who are...
A liberal African American congresswoman,
exactly.
Like no BS.
And you know what Ron Paul said about that? He said this in an interview with Lou Rockwell, his old congressional aide, early last year. He said, "Yeah, the only reason why Barbara Lee and then other members of the Black Caucus are, whenever they are opposed to military interventionism or raising budgets, is because they want to transfer that money to food stamps for their Black constituents."
Oh, that's nice.
He said that straight up. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the other thing I want to say.
Yeah.
I know we're getting slightly off topic, but the idea that liberals on the left, I mean, which there was a big contingent of them apologizing for and covering for Ron Paul for quite a long time, that he is somehow crazier. I'm sorry, that Trump is, you know, totally off the map, crazy fascist, but Ron Paul was great, is insane to me. Have you ever read his newsletters? I mean, the racism that came out of his mouth makes Trump look like
Nelson Mandela. Know,
looks like Mother Teresa. Yeah, like Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa. Yeah. You know,
Mark, I think we lost him. I guess.
You just
cut out, man. Okay, go. Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying that it, at least in the domestic policies, Trump, at least as far as we know, is not a extreme social Darwinist the way that Ron Paul and the other libertarians are. I mean,
no, there's no doubt. No, there's no doubt about it.
Social Darwinism is fascism.
Social Darwinism is a fascism. So this is actually important because this is the thread that runs through Ron Paul and it runs through Gary Johnson, and we'll loop back to Gary Johnson. But the story, and we've actually talked about different elements of the story before. We talked about the role of libertarians going back to the 70s and actually in Holocaust denial and in every toxic political idea that there is room for in the United States, from racism to social Darwinism to anti-Semitism to anything else, to misogyny to, wanting to
race eugenics.
So how
because it's about inequality.
Because it's about exactly. So how going back to the 70s did this form of just sort of, a hybrid of like overactive fantasy life and total social brutality, which is what libertarianism is, how did it get this patina that, that's the contingent that people say like, oh, well, I'm liberal and I don't like conservatives, but I respect the principles of someone like Ron Paul, or I like that Gary Johnson's talking about this or that. What was the brand strategy going back to the 70s that leveraged these ideas? And I think it's, it's important because we've talked about this. This stuff has kind of died down the last couple of years, but it's about to have a resurgence because of the Donald Trump frame. So we're going to come back to this whole, libertarians are the real conservatives thing.
Or libertarians are the real alternative and Hillary and Trump are the same. When in fact they're all three very, very occupied, very narrow band of the right wing, and Trump and Gary Johnson are on the far right, and Hillary is on the sort of mainstream right, I would say,
And far more preferable to both, if we're being real.
Yeah,
no doubt.
I mean, you could make that argument. I don't know. They all make me sick, to be honest. But if you have to put one of those guns to your head, So where did the strategy came from? Yeah. I mean, the brains, the real brains behind it, besides Charles Koch, who is in his own way, as oligarchs go, he is kind of a genius. The way he's kind of ordered his world and then ordered our world around his world. But his own sort of brain bug for this was Murray Rothbard. And Murray Rothbard he probably is of all of the libertarian pantheon thinkers, the Ayn Rands and Hayek. He's kind of the most interesting and the most overtly horrible, like an absolute waffen dweeb little fascist nut. But kind of a good writer, which is unusual, and kind of an interesting guy. Here's the guy who's like talked about setting up market exchanges for children's organs and children and babies. And, he ended life as David Duke's biggest supporter and backer and Buchanan. But in any event, what Murray Rothbard, who was like a big fan of Joe McCarthy in the 50s and Franco in the 40s, what he saw with the hippie movement in the late 60s and early 70s was a huge opportunity to fuse the baby boomer hippie generation's anti-government. And they, for them, it was less about economics because they were still quite young, and it was what they saw all the problems emanating from evil government, the wars around the world, especially in Vietnam, the spying at home, the CIA, Hoover, everything was government. And so what they saw was an opportunity to create a consistent philosophy that would appeal to well-off, more well-to-do post-hippies, I guess you'd say, who were entering the workforce and starting to think about their material lives, where you would fuse their natural anti-government politics, leave me alone, let me smoke pot, don't fight wars, with what the Kochs want and all the, extraction industry and finance industry people who back libertarianism want, which is no EPA, no taxes, no regulations, no Social Security, no public schools, and so on.
Let me poison the groundwater and listen to Bob Dylan in peace.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and this arises with really the depoliticization of you know, generations. I mean, people have become increasingly depoliticized and mistaking, you know, Twitter and clicks and things like this for politics. Like, I think we're pretty politically confused these days too, so they can take advantage of that too.
Right. So that's interesting, because there's actually three threads here that run through that I want, that you can expand on, and actually kind of takes us through 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then we'll get us to this disturbing thread with Gary Johnson and this sort of new Coke outreach in some respects. We'll get to that in a second. But it just occurs to me that, you know, we talked last year about Seymour Hersh. And this dovetails exactly what you're talking about, which is that he did in this incredible reporting exposing U.S. war crimes in Vietnam, exposing the intelligence apparatus. But when he went after the corporate state, essentially, that was when, you know, like the New York Times had to back down. That was when he couldn't report with the same rigor. Then on another track, you know, there's Thomas Frank's new book, Listen Liberal, which is really good book. Where he talks about, and then that's how the Democratic Party started to, you know, not quite, obviously not as far as this kind of libertarian craziness, but much closer than it should have been, when the Democratic Party went to this sort of like, let's minimize government and we'll become a kind of party of sort of social and personal self-actualization. And then you have this space that is on one hand the muscle of it, which you see in the Hirsch story you reported, and then this broader kind of cultural acceptance which ran through like the mainstream of the Democratic Party through the Bill Clinton era for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, what was Clinton, you know, is he is what libertarians kind of announced themselves to be, an extremist, which is socially liberal, fiscally conservative. I mean, that's Clinton too.
Right.
So, the libertarians kind of take that to the extreme, and I think that's Charles Koch and Charles Koch, you know, forever channeling Murray Rothbard too, which is you always want to have an extreme ideal and be able to keep a fired up base somewhat outside of a mainstream party and influence it that way. That's what he learned from his father with the John Birch Society. I mean, the John Birch Society wound up having this, you know, outsized leverage over the Republican Party by staying a step outside of the Republican Party and forcing it rightward. I mean, they're the reason why Nixon lost in 62 for the governorship for California, and they're the reason why Reagan won. I mean, Reagan kind of owes his entire political career to the John Birch Society helping him to power. And I think they saw that. And you know, but the Libertarian Party is mostly John Birch Society politics, just sold differently,
right?
Sold differently to a different generation,
right? Yeah. So that's sold. So that's, and then I think that this thread comes through now, where when we talk about Gary Johnson, and first we'll get to the kind of present predicament and the branding stuff. But before we do that, explain a little bit more, because you wrote in this initial piece that you wrote about Gary Johnson, which is called the Gary Johnson Swindle and the Degradation of Third Party Politics, and you actually wrote this in 2012, and this is just sort of like an update on it, essentially. But you went into, we've already discussed how on military and foreign policy, this guy is, you know, far from a dove, obviously. But also that his criminal justice record as governor of New Mexico, in contrast to this pot image, was one of the most brutal, punitive, even by 1990 standards, and that was the trendy thing to do. What was he doing in terms of the prison crisis when he was actually governing? And then how does it relate to privatization as well?
Right. Well, I mean, so first of all, his campaign was heavily financed by two major interests. And there are probably others, but the two ones that will concern us now are Wackenhut then, which is now GEO, which is the big one of the two major private prison builders.
And GEO Group.
GEO Group. And, you know, this was just starting to be an idea in the early 90s, and New Mexico wound up becoming the first big test case lab for privatizing prisons. And the thing is, New Mexico had a history. I mean, because there was a huge riot. It's, you know, there's even like old documentaries about this in 1980. 30 or 40 inmates were killed in this riot. They wound up having all kinds of, you know, huge prison reforms because of that, of these riots in the prisons in New Mexico in 1980. And so they had come to a sort of a somewhat better position, let's say, after 1980, until Gary Johnson, you know, paid back his Wackenhut Geo Group funders in the 90s. He wound up, he ran on hardcore law and order, lock everybody up, and wound up massively increasing the prison population and then stuffing them into the private prisons that were hastily built. And that led to, within a few years of his tenure, the first major riots because of all the abuse that was going on and, people weren't getting their meals. I mean, everything's based on profit, so you obviously treat the prisoners worse in order to squeeze more profit out of everyone. And the way he responded to that was, and he got called out by, like, Human Rights Watch, he sent off prisoners from his private prisons to a federal supermax in Virginia. He just shipped them out to some absolute utter hell dystopia. Right. And this is how he governed. I mean, he governed from the extreme far right. He lock up anyone caught with a joint, all this stuff. And he later, of course, said he repented. This is what you do when you're a Republican, a far right Republican. This is another use for the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian label is you can always, credibility wash yourself by saying I'm now a libertarian. It's like becoming a born again Christian for more secular Republicans. Look how many you didn't even hear about all these libertarians until 2005, 2006, 2007 when it was clear that Bush was destroying the label. Suddenly it was I'm a libertarian.
Exactly.
That meant you didn't have to go to the left and accept left actual politics, which are redistribution of wealth, labor, social programs. You just said, I'm actually, very principled in being anti-interventionist, which is a bunch of horseshit. So anyway, so that was one of the things that has been very much lost in the memory hole, which is
I want kids to drink arsenic, but I don't have a problem with gay people.
But he didn't govern that way as governor. And the other thing he did, he was also heavily backed by the Koch brothers, and obviously they fund the entire, there would be no libertarian movement without them. And he paid them back at this time in the 90s. Koch Industries, one of its larger subsidiaries was Koch Asphalt. I think it was called Koch Asphalt, but it was asphalt. They were huge in the asphalt business, which again is funny. They're anti-government, but all the asphalt, all the road paving is, it's all government contracts.
Sure.
And so they wound up widening. They basically bankrupted. Gary Johnson bankrupted the state treasury to widen the road using Koch asphalt on these like horrible credit terms, and spent like $500 million or just enormous amounts of money on this. It's a very poor state. And they wound up not being able to cover the money, cover the losses on it, and they wound up having to take out of other programs and so on. This is another huge scandal that he's been able to just sort of, walk away from. It's lost in the memory hole. You can find it all in the local media. There's another reason why the Kochs would want to defund local, investigative reporting in places like Albuquerque and Santa Fe, because, people find this stuff out. But that's how he governed, and I got to tell you, when you get past the sound bites and what you're being sold by the Reason magazine people, and then even sort of like left libertarians and like Glenn Greenwald and those kind of people, when you dig a layer below the surface and see, well, what do they really support? Even on pot, even on drugs, and I went and saw Gary Johnson speak and debate personally. He's only for ending the federal ban. So states can throw anybody in jail for pot that they want to under Gary Johnson.
So this has nothing to do. This isn't going to make any impact in a state that still wants totally. Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing that just strikes me, and I think that this is the broader question, and I want to get your kind of your bigger thoughts on the whole election and this whole field before we wrap up. But the other thing that's interesting to me is that, of course, he sort of says he regrets sentencing people to harsh sentences for drug laws, for drug law violations. And then, as you point out, he's only talking about a federal ban, which it's even kind of even more ironic than that, because theoretically, as a libertarian, he wouldn't even want, you know, federal laws in some sense are kind of null and void regardless. So it's not even, it's kind of just like a almost a totally irrelevant policy statement from a libertarian perspective. But he never reversed himself or recanted on prison privatization. And that to me is a very, because, you know, I think you know, on a practical level, you know, there's this notion that there's a lot of buy-in across the political spectrum on prison reform. But I have to say, like, I would you know, keep one hand, like, on, you know, ready to bear, because these same people still want to privatize the prison industry. They still want to outsource all of those responsibilities to companies like GEO, who don't just do prisons. They also run, like, detention centers that immigrants are held in and all the rest of it. So he never, you know, and that's, again, where we see, just like going back to the 70s, as you've reported, this stuff that gets wrapped up in the package of a weed brownie is really just like hardcore, brutal, plutocrat politics like any other, and maybe even more aggressive.
And, I think so. I think he is. I think he's the most far right candidate of the three. He's come out in this cycle and said he's, quote, Sharia phobic. He's called for banning burqas, federal ban on burqas.
Very libertarian.
He's done it. Now, he did it. Yeah, he did it in Reason, and then the next day he kind of half recanted, because the Reason people basically tried to give him every opportunity to back out of it. It turns out he's been saying that in interviews, like to the Albuquerque Journal. That is his position. He wants a federal ban. Right. I mean, again, you know, libertarianism, it does have a principle, and the principle is hierarchical, massively unequal, social Darwinist society, and everything is subordinate to that. But he's, you know, he's an extreme right candidate. I don't know why people won't open their eyes to that. I find it sad. But, you know, again, if you have libertarian networks backing you up, it means ultimately you have, you know, the wealthiest brothers in the entire world, for starters, and a lot of other wealthy people, Silicon Valley and on the East Coast, who can fund PR. The other thing is, one of the things that I found, that I discovered when I wrote up Gary Johnson in 2012, I mean, his entire super PAC and nonprofit and his whole campaign was run by far right GOP operatives. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who basically weaponized and pushed all birtherism. So, you know, again, you have the Donald Trump link here. Roger Stone, who was Donald Trump's, you know, doppelganger in politics for years now, Roger Stone was one of his advisors. He joined the Libertarian Party and joined the Gary Johnson campaign. And he kind of goes back and forth between libertarians and Trump. And I think he's taught Trump a lot of things from the libertarians and back and forth on that, too. Like, oh, it turns out if you're anti-interventionist, you know, there's a huge part of the population that wants to hear this now. So, you know, Trump has adopted a lot of libertarian positions, and I'll bet you a lot of self-identified libertarians are pro-Trump. You know, they're definitely not pro-Hillary.
Right, and just the tone, like when Trump does his whole kind of like, when he subordinates Chris Christie, that kind of like plays into the kind of ethos of the sort of social Darwinism you're talking about. Although I will admit it is pretty funny. Very funny watching what he does to Chris Christie.
Watching him, practice social Darwinism on this like political and you know, oligarchical elite is funny to watch.
Is the most pleasurable part.
It is. You know, it'll end badly the day he takes office, but
everything
up until then is pretty damn satisfying to watch.
No, I mean, because they're low energy, and frankly, they should stop eating Oreos, and also he's a loser. My favorite, I just have to say before we get to the final questions here, low energy is the classic, but it's not remembered as well because Rick Perry was so irrelevant. But when Trump did the whole thing of like, he's wearing glasses, but it doesn't work. he's not smart, and that he should be forced to take an IQ test before he could debate. I think that was the moment when I was like, I just have to accept this. This is amazing.
I know. Yeah. He should. I mean, if it all fails, and at the end, he should do like Jake LaMotta at the end of Raging Bull, and just do comedy club.
Exactly.
Because I'd pay to see that.
Oh, me too. I would totally enjoy. Yeah. Or the only other one I remember. I just have to share this as well. I don't know if you remember this, but the day after he announced, he was on Bill O'Reilly. And, O'Reilly's doing is like, oh, what are you going to do about Iraq? All that crap. And Trump's all over, he's like a pinball. He's like, on one hand, like we like more non-interventionist, but then I'm going to bomb ISIS and take their oil, all of that. And and he said one of these really belligerent things. And O'Reilly goes, you sound like Bush now. You sound like W. And Trump doesn't miss a beat. He just looks at O'Reilly and goes, yeah, I'm a little smarter. And I was like, my God, I'm so glad that this dude is running right now.
It's beautiful to have that shoved in their face.
Like, yeah, I'm a little smarter. Oh, my God. So apropos of that, what I really wonder is, I know that you cut your teeth in many ways working in Russia. And you have a very keen sense of Eastern European politics. And I find sometimes when people draw these analogies, like they get really strained, and everybody has their own kind of, particulars in history, obviously. But we're going into an election cycle, and I'm very open. I want Hillary Clinton to defeat Donald Trump. I make no bones about that. But in the bigger picture, widen the aperture, we have, we have a status quo, unaccountable, plutocratic candidate. We have literally a buffoonish kind of proto-fascist buffoonish candidate. I guess, do you see our politics even more and more resembling what you saw in some respects in Eastern Europe? And conversely, is it just that what we exported to post-Cold War Russia and all the rest is coming back home to roost with us in new and unprecedented ways?
Yeah, I know the second part of what you said, absolutely. What we exported, tolerated, and nurtured, and protected as market economics and a proper way of ordering a society, and democracy definitely is coming back to haunt us. I think so, and I think one of the things that made this analogy clear to me in a huge, horrible way, the first big time was the financial collapse in 2008, and then the bailouts to all the insiders and no one going to jail. I mean, that was right out of Russia. That was shocking to me. And I think, it still shocks a lot of people that not one banker went to jail. They destroyed the entire global financial system. And I saw this in Russia in 1998, the oligarchs then, which ran the country with a drunk Yeltsin as kind of this, figurehead, and then behind them stood people like Larry Summers and Bob Rubin and the IMF, and they screwed up everything, but they made a few people incredibly wealthy. They impoverished huge amounts of people, so everything is done on a scale that's more extreme than here.
Right.
And then everything collapsed, and none of them went to jail, and some of them even got to stick around and took on new guises, and their politics wound up losing faith in democracy, in establishment narratives, in what they were being told, and wound up gravitating towards an authoritarian figure who would put the oligarchs in their place, who would put the media in its place, because the media was so false and corrupt, would put democracy in its place, since it cheated everybody too. And so, I think you're seeing it here unfolding, unraveling in a much slower, it's happening in a slower way. And we didn't just go through a traumatic sort of collapse of the empire. So things move faster in Russia. But I think it's absolutely right. Yeah.
And how can we have, because I think like the terrain is basically like, there's a lot of positive coming out of Bernie Sanders' run in terms of like the macro trend of, at least having a return to kind of just robust basic liberalism, and that message resonating with young people so much because they're, you know, they're on the receiving end of so many of these things. And then you have Trump, as I say, and I, you know, I will keep using terms like proto-fascist or whatever. And you don't have to make foreign analogies, like you've written, you know, and we'll talk about other times, historical examples in the United States that are fascistic and reflect Donald Trump. But then you have Hillary, and I think, you know, maybe you and I have like a disagreement about voting for her or whatever, but that's not even my prime interest. My prime interest is that, you know, as you know, this, as Tony Caron, who's another, you know, great journalist, talked to a couple months ago, he talked about the time of insurgency and instability in America. And what happens when you elect somebody who is so fundamentally status quo at a time that is really fundamentally not? And I think that those, you know, as I say, there's a crack of light with the Sanders thing. But then with this current choice, it just seems to me that there's a lot that, you know, playing out those analogies, they keep going in very ugly directions.
Yeah, and I also would kind of dispute the idea of a trend. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm amazed and impressed as hell that Bernie got this far. And I personally still believe, and I have certain evidence, you know, anyway, it's kind of out there, that he never quite was sure that he really wanted it. I mean,
oh yeah, no, I don't think that that's that out there. No, I think that's totally legit. Yeah.
And I mean, that goes into the structure of his campaign and everything. And that's kind of messed up. Yeah. And I think that could also kind of have a dampening effect on people when it starts hitting the hardcore. And it's too bad. His politics are great. I mean, I would say this, one of the trends that is a constant between Trump and Sanders is that, I mean, if neoliberal politics that was first really brought in by Reagan, a little bit by Carter, but definitely by Reagan, is the idea that politics, you know, fail, and that markets, you know, basically leave politics to the markets.
Right.
What you have, and that politicians are always self-interested and screw up and so on. What you have in both these candidates is a, in their own ways, a return to politics. I mean, Sanders kind of like a return to the idea that politics can solve problems along the lines of the New Deal or like the social democracies in Northern Europe. But even with Trump, I mean, people on the right certainly have such a deeply ingrained belief in entrepreneurs as and billionaires as supermen, as meretricious supermen.
Right.
That you know, and he's not saying I'm not going to do anything. He's not saying, like every candidate, you know, going back to Reagan, the problem is government and so on. He's not saying that. He's saying he's going to move mountains. I mean,
right.
So this is kind of in both instances, people giving up on the neoliberal kind of failed model and in its own warped way, turning back to politics again as a way of solving political problems. And I find that kind of interesting. And Trump, you know, Trump is, I would call him a far right populist. And only I'm a pedant about these things, but I mean, fascism in its, you know, origins do matter. Fascism is originally very specifically anti-communist,
Oh man, I hope I
talking about anti-democracy,
right?
And Trump is there's. I mean, it just blows my mind that a self-described socialist can even go this far. But that's not what he's really running against. So it seems to me much more. I don't know if that's any less or more dangerous than a fascist. I'm being a pedant here.
No, I think that's totally fair, and I think that's legitimate. Yeah. And I actually think it's interesting because the last thing I would say is that I found these comparisons between Bernie and Trump to mostly be nonsense because they represent such different things. But that's on point. Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah. And then the other thing that I would add to that is I do think that, you know, I don't want that dude to be president, but I do think that the kind of the sanctimonious freakouts about him are not going to help get the job done. Because there's so much skeptic, like you know, when you read a piece, and I'll just let you take a hit at this right before we sign off. But when you read a piece by Robert Kagan of all people, talking about you know fascism and using the word in a way, I mean, maybe we shouldn't be using it at all. I'm listening to what you're saying, but using it in a way less sort of with less caveats than I use it. You know what I mean? Going to the Washington Post editorial page and writing this big melodramatic scare story about Trump, which, you know, fair enough. This guy is literally a co-architect of a global war system, a surveillance state, and Guantanamo through his influence on Cheney and
he's an architect of Nuremberg war crimes, war crimes that are war crimes under the Nuremberg statutes, including a war of aggression. Exactly. I can tell you how you can translate it. I mean, these are all neocons, and they all believe in the noble lies and the lies that, you know, that the dumb masses always need to hear. So this time, but if you really want to just like, if you would put his article and then you'd have, I don't know, you score pee on or lemon juice, you know, and see what the actual message is. It's Trump's people aren't calling me for a job. So I'm going to scare everybody until Trump gives me a job or my wife. It's obvious because he didn't make any other argument besides that or ever account for the fact. If you've read some of his crazy, like Bush era articles, you know, Bush is the greatest, you know, he is going forward alone. He embodies the genius of, I mean, it's like talking about Mussolini, you know, it really is. It's one for one almost. This deification of Bush as the war president, and he should not listen to a single person, including not even his own aides, because he's imbued with this martial spirit. I mean, it's nuts.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that was mainstream writing from people during an actual administration actually conducting wars. And now all of a sudden, you know, and again, I'm talking
about a moron, as Trump said, you know, and we're also talking about a moron.
Right. And I'm not saying it to in any way sort of like minimize Trump. I'm also just seeing even tactically, like I see these numbers blow up on these articles, blow up on my timelines. And I'm like,
yes, I know.
Do you really think that this, I mean, like, you know, that this is going to have any influence on, like, as an example, somebody in Pennsylvania who's weighing their options? Like, oh, well, you know, I'm making $30,000 a year. I don't really trust any of these people. Yeah. Trump is questionable, but I don't know. But I just read some sanctimonious freakout piece by David Brooks, and now, I mean, I definitely know how to vote. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what goes through people's heads with making these cases. But Mark Ames, as always, man, I learned so much talking to you. It's always a pleasure, and let's go get drinks soon. Thanks, man.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half, although I thought that was pretty fun. And we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. You can IM whenever you want. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Go to majority.fm/become a member. And you'll get the whole show for just $10 a month. It's less than a cup of coffee a day. Of course, if you choose to pay more, you can pay more. But the baseline is just $10 a month, less than a cup of coffee a day. Probably in many cases, some accumulation of like your couch change, a dollar or two in the car seat. $10 could probably figure out. As we told you before, we're shifting to a new member system. So things are going to be better in your feed. But over the next couple of days, there might be a few kinks. You might get the same download twice. You can send us a note at majorityreporters@gmail.com, but rest assured that it's not a big problem. It's not something that you're only dealing with, and it will be taken care of in a timely manner. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys Pod. That's 2DopeBoysPod.com. That's our website, and that's spelled out. On iTunes, it's the number 2, Dope Boys, and a podcast. We're on Stitcher now, 2 Dope Boys and a podcast. Use our link at Majority Report Kickback to go to our Jet link, the ethical alternative to Amazon, or to our Amazon link and skim a little bit off of your purchases there. We'll see you in the fun half.